WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. It is The Big Picture. Derek Gary, just Derek Gary, with you until 9 o'clock tonight. 855-915-9636 if you must call. If you must, I'm going to ask, as I always do when Shea Spillane is not here, that the phone calls be kept to a minimum, just because trying to run the board, run the show, run my mouth, and run a telephone call is a bit more than any single human being can handle. We have no producers here. I have no call screener. Everything comes through me. And when Shay's around, I can always throw it to Shay and say, hey, say something while I talk to this person on the phone. But when it's just me, it gets a little tricky. So not that I don't love you, not that we don't love to hear from our listeners, just that you're asking me to do one more thing that I can possibly do. It is a warm and toasty Wednesday night. And we, Shay Spillane, by the way, I would be remiss if I did not explain where Shay Spillane is. Shay Spillane has set a goal in her life to visit all 50 United States. And she's out knocking several of those off of her list over the course of a week with her dad. She was last seen scaling Devil's Tower from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I believe that's in Wyoming. So that will give you some idea of what part of the country she's in. She's in the Great American Northwest. And she will be back next week, and I will be back next week, and life will go on. But for now, it is new day dawning. If you happen to be over in the Everett area this weekend, really, you don't want to be anywhere near the Everett area this weekend. From WCVB, Encore Boston Harbor, Everett officials discuss opening day safety transportation plans for new casino. Ahead of this weekend's opening of the new casino in Everett, that's on Sunday, kids, the casino opens. Hotel officials and city leaders are downplaying concerns about traffic and emphasizing that they've spent years planning for the big day. What could possibly go wrong? Don't worry about the traffic. We've spent years planning. Okay. Encore Boston Harbor, a $2.6 billion project, is scheduled to open Sunday. Finishing touches are still being made, but three VIP preview days are already underway. My invite was somehow lost in the mail, or maybe it went to the spam folder in my email. I did not see my invite to the casino VIP grand opening. I am very disappointed. Casino officials expect 50,000 people or more could show up for opening day. Quote, the opening of Encore and all that goes with it is something we've been discussing for some time now, said Chief Stephen Mazzi of the Everett Police Department. Mazzi compared the situation to Y2K, saying the concerns of a traffic meltdown are overblown. Quote, as we move forward on after opening day, I believe everything is going to be just fine, he said. I want to parse that quote just for a second. As we move forward and on after opening day, I believe everything is going to be just fine. Do you notice he said after opening day? Which is basically Everett's police chief saying, yeah, you probably don't want to be anywhere near here on Sunday. Encore and city leaders are encouraging people to take alternative transportation because there are only about 3,000 parking spots on the casino's property. Parking in those spaces will cost $22 for 6 hours and $42 for 24 hours. You can park downtown for that rate. You gotta do some wins at the slot machines just to pay for your parking. They don't have free parking at the casino. $22 to park. The casino runs harbor shuttles across the water and bus shuttles from several locations, including Malden Center and Wellington MBTA stations. Because when I am going to stay at a five-star, Encore is a five-star casino and hotel. And when I'm going to stay at a five-star casino and hotel, I want to take the T to Malden Center and get on a shuttle bus. This is so poorly thought out. This is so incredibly poorly thought out. And as the police chief said, and I believe he's being honest about this, as we move forward and on after opening day, I believe everything is going to be just fine. Yes, 2 months from now. 2 months from now, they will have figured out how to deal with all of the traffic around the casino. In the meantime, we have a casino with a 50,000 capacity and 3,000 parking spaces that you have to pay for. So if you're doing that thing where you just bring what you're willing to lose to the casino, don't forget to put $22 in your back pocket for the parking. Otherwise, you will never leave the casino. They will have your car forever. CBS Boston added this. On its busiest days, the casino operators expect about 50,000 people. Peak times are anticipated to be Friday nights, Saturdays, and Sundays. Now, a car, average car, will hold four people, four adults comfortably. So if every car in the garage has four people in it, that's 12,000 people. Where are the other 38,000 people supposed to park? Because this is what everybody's going to do. Everyone is going to converge on the casino on Sunday. Nothing will move in Sullivan Square. Nothing will move on Route 99. Nothing will move around Assembly Row. Nothing will move on Main Street in Everett. And there will probably be, from all of these other backups, massive backups on 93 North and South, trying to get into the city and trying to get out of the city, because both of those go past the casino. 3,000 parking spaces, 50,000 person capacity. You do the math.
Talk me out of going.
You do the math. The only way that this works, the only way that this works is if everybody rides electric scooters over to the casino. Oh, and they are going to have a staging area for Uber across the street. So that's a win. You can take an Uber, but you're going to be sitting in traffic. There is no direct public transportation route. There's no subway that will take you to this casino. Which means if you take an Uber, if you rent a car, if you take a Lyft, if you try and take a bus, anything with four wheels, you are going to be stuck in traffic for hours. If you really, really, really must go, the fastest way to get there is going to be to take the Orange Line to Sullivan Station and walk. And it's only, I think, maybe a 1 mile walk to the casino from Sullivan Station. Normally, that would be a very dangerous place to walk because there's a lot of high-speed intersections in there. But as I said, nothing is going to be moving in that neighborhood for the next 2 months. So you can take the T to Sullivan. I guess you could take the T to the Orange Line stop at Assembly Row, and they're going to have water shuttles. And water shuttles are probably going to be a faster way to get to the casino than driving, because at least they can move back and forth across the river. But you're going to be waiting for that, too. My advice, if you want to go, don't, number one. Number two, if you want to go, take the T, take the Orange Line to Sullivan, and walk. And laugh at everybody crowded along the banks of the Mystic River waiting for a water shuttle. And laugh at everybody who took a Lyft or an Uber or anything else and realized that it is just one more car in this sea of unmoving traffic sitting around the Encore Casino. 2 months is my over-under on when this is going to start to clear out. And it's not because they haven't done a whole ton of work to try and upgrade the intersections around there. It's everything to do with the fact that none of this was built to handle any kind of traffic capacity. Those of you who know the area, people who have driven on Route 99, know it's a mess at rush hour. The only thing that would make it complete, the only thing that could make this a complete disaster, would be if the drawbridge on Route 99 failed and you could no longer get to the casino from Boston or Somerville. Because then everything is just going to back up in Everett and Revere, and nothing is going to move in Malden, Everett, or Revere. So we'll see how that pans out. Should be a good time. By the way, don't go to the casino until you find out what the odds are going to be for the games out there. And there are websites that will tell you, obviously, for games like poker or blackjack or whatever, the odds are the same no matter what you're doing. If you're playing one of those big six wheels or something like that, the odds are terrible. You shouldn't play that. But there are websites that track and publish the odds for slot machines. And for the opening of the casino, it's always that big question. Are they going to be super loose? So everyone's like, oh, look at all the big winners. Or are they going to be super tight because they know people are going to come anyway? As a rule, casinos like to run their slot machines tight. Plainville, down near Gillette Stadium in the southern central part of Massachusetts, was losing business for a long time because its slot machines were so tight. Everybody figured out, oh, you can go down to Twin River, which is about another hour's drive, and actually win at the slot machines. So Plain Ridge Park actually loosened up their slot machines a little bit and became a worthwhile place to go again. Of course, I'm going to tell you that the only games that you ever want to play in a casino are poker, where there is no house edge. You're playing against other people. The house gets a cut. And video poker, where if you know what you're doing, only if you know what you're doing, the house edge is 0.5%. You will not find a better house edge on any game in a casino anywhere. There's no guaranteed wins. The house always wins unless you're playing poker. Then they just get a rake. And if you play video poker and you know what you're doing and you can at least break even at it, and you're playing with one of the loyalty cards, because all these casinos have these programs where they will give you a rewards card or a loyalty card, and they track how much you spend, and then they give you points or, you know, free drinks, free hotel rooms, whatever it is. You can just sort of make bank on those free rewards if you play video poker and you know what you're doing. That's why there are fewer video poker machines than anything else in a casino, and that's why they're hidden somewhere in the back corner of the casino where no one is meant to go. They may be in an area behind a door marked employees only. You got to ask around if you want to find the video poker, because casinos know there are some people who want to play it, but they also know that people who know how to play it can beat the house. Just a little advice. Stay out of that neighborhood. Just to stay completely away from Sullivan Square unless you're on the Orange Line for the next 2 months. If it gets better sometime before then, and I'm taking this to heart too, because my favorite bar for Wednesday nights is just outside of Sullivan Square. I may not be going there for the next 2 months. Not because I don't love you, Tavern at the End of the World, but because 50,000 person capacity casino, 3,000 parking spaces. Who does this? Who does this and expects that it's going to be anything other than a disaster? Once things start going south for this casino, and they will, because it is the wrong casino in the wrong place, the first thing that they'll do is they will start mowing things down and adding more parking and putting up more garages, and there will suddenly be free parking available at the casino. For now, everyone is operating under the illusion that this is going to be some massive, overwhelming success, even though you are running a 5-star hotel with breathtaking views of the upper and lower deck of 93 on one side, the Mystic River Bridge currently under construction on another side, a shopping mall on another side, and liquid natural gas tanks on the fourth side. I guess the luxury hotel people don't come for the views. News to me. In other community local news, this is a bad day for somebody. From 7 News, investigation underway after landscaper finds human remains behind Wakefield home. Authorities are investigating after what appeared to be human remains were found behind a home in Wakefield on Monday. Emergency crews could be seen scouring the area behind a home on Lakeshore Drive after a landscaper found what appeared to be human bones, shoes, and clothing behind a shed, according to the Middlesex District Attorney's Office. A preliminary investigation suggests the human remains had been outside for an extended period of time. Edson Pinto, who made the grim discovery, said he immediately called 911. Quote, "When I went down there, I saw the jaw, and then I realized it was a body," he told 7 News. A representative of the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner responded to the scene to take custody of the remains so that an autopsy can be conducted in the hopes of identifying the person and determining their cause of death. Patrick Saucier, who just bought the home, said he was having work done before his family moves in next month. Quote, "The guy was doing the roof and called me and said they just found a dead body in your backyard," Saucier said. The incident is being investigated by the Middlesex District Attorney's Office and Wakefield Police. In a statement, Wakefield Police Chief Stephen Scorey said, "We appreciate the patience and assistance of members of the public today as this investigation is conducted. No additional information was immediately available." That's what 7 News had. Now, an additional detail was available to the folks over at CBS Local, who talked to a neighbor, Madeline Donnelly, who said the previous owner moved out a few years ago. She rented to a sober house, and there was a young man living there and a couple of girls, too. "I used to see them go by there for a walk in the afternoon," Donnelly said. So this house, which is a nice big house, it's on the end of a dead-end street right off of Lake Quanapowhat. If you are from the North Shore, you know that area. This is the rich part of town. So apparently, at some point, I'm guessing while this was a sober house, and I don't know how long it stopped being a sober house, somebody apparently walked out back and died in back of the shed. There isn't any evidence to suggest foul play here, but really all they found were bones and clothes. So certainly they're going to investigate that. But given that this was a sober house, this is my best guess. This is not fact. But my best guess is they're going to come back and determine that this was somebody who had died of a drug overdose. And the sad thing is no one realized that person was missing. No one knew that. They probably assumed that that person had left, that person had given up on sobriety. Maybe they were back in a treatment center somewhere. But somebody probably walked away from the sober house and died in back of the shed. I don't know that I still want the house under those circumstances. I don't know what Mr. Saucier's family has to say about any of this. It's not like somebody died in the house and you found a body in the house. I mean, it is in the backyard and in back of the shed. And apparently, there's no reason for anyone to go in back of the shed because no one had been in back of the shed for several years. So a little bit of another little bit of interesting drama in Wakefield, which has had its share. You may remember that the church, the Wakefield Baptist Church, right on the square, caught fire last fall and burned to the ground. So Wakefield is usually super, super quiet place, but lately, who knows what's going on in national news. It's going to be a... what's the word I'm looking for? Not dry. Snowless. Maybe snowless. It is going to be a snowless summer somewhere. Because a record cocaine bust has been made in the United States. And you are not going to believe how much cocaine they managed to find. This is from CBS, Philadelphia. This was at a port in Philadelphia. One of the largest cocaine busts in United States history happened Tuesday in Philadelphia. Federal authorities continue to comb a cargo ship at Packer Avenue Marine Terminal in South Philadelphia. So far, they've seized 16.5 tons. Let me give you that number again. 16.5 tons, 33,000 pounds of cocaine, which has a street value of more than $1 billion, the U.S. Attorney's Office says. $1 billion, 16.5 tons of cocaine. Investigators believe there is still a significant amount of cocaine remaining on the ship. It is the largest drug seizure in the history of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. 2 people were arrested and federally charged. According to the criminal complaint, Ivan Durasevich, the ship's second mate, and Fonafane Tisagara were arrested in the bust. Before coming to Philadelphia, the Mediterranean Shipping Company ship was previously in the Bahamas, Panama, Peru, and Colombia. The ship was on its way to the Netherlands. According to the complaint, Durasevich admitted his role to authorities in bringing cocaine onto the vessel after being offered $50,000 by the chief officer. Durasevich told authorities the cocaine was loaded onto the ship after leaving Peru. Tisaga told authorities that 6 boats approached the MSC Guyane during the night while Jurasevich operated a crane to bring bags of cocaine on board. The ship was later approached by another 8 boats, where more cocaine was loaded onto the ship, according to the complaint. Tsiasaga told authorities his role was to help in moving the drugs below decks. Quote, a U.S. Customs and Border Protection and Immigration Customs Enforcement Homeland Security Investigations-led multi-agency inspection of shipping containers aboard the MSC Guyane resulted in a substantial cocaine seizure in Philadelphia on June 17, 2019. Authorities continue to process the seized cocaine and continue its inspection aboard the vessel in the port of Philadelphia. Authorities have made 2 arrests and will release a final tally and additional details when this operation concludes, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection said in a statement. Authorities say agents boarded the vessel, identified the container in question, inspected it, and removed it from the vessel. It was then taken to an undisclosed federal facility for analysis. Authorities are weighing the cocaine at the location and looking for other evidence, including DNA. The length of the investigation could continue long enough that the vessel will have to be moved to make way for other incoming ship traffic. U.S. Attorney William McSwain was personally overseeing parts of the investigation and drug seizure. Quote, this is one of the largest drug seizures in United States history. This amount of cocaine could kill millions, millions of people, McSwain tweeted. The Mediterranean Shipping Company said in a statement they are taking this matter very seriously. Quote, Mediterranean Shipping Company is aware of reports of an incident at the Port of Philadelphia in which U.S. authorities made a seizure of illicit cargo. That's an understatement. MSC takes this matter very seriously and is grateful to the authorities for identifying any suspected abuse of its services, the statement reads. Unfortunately, shipping and logistics companies are from time to time affected by trafficking problems. MSC has a long-standing history of cooperating with U.S. federal enforcement agencies to help disrupt illegal narcotics trafficking and works closely with U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Mayor Jim Kenney's office said in a statement that Kenney is thankful for the hard work of local and federal authorities. Quote, every ounce of drugs we keep off the streets is helping to keep Philadelphians safe and alive. Well, you got a lot of ounces there, Mayor Kenney. A lot of ounces. Everyone in Philadelphia gets to live for another year, apparently. Mayor Kenney is thankful for the hard work of the Philadelphia Police Department, FBI, ICE, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, and the U.S. Coast Guard, the mayor's office said in a statement. So, 2 interesting details in this. I find the statement from Mediterranean Shipping Company very interesting. I don't think they knew this was going on. And there are a couple of realities that you run into when you're dealing with major drug seizures from a shipping company. One is that the shipping company knows what's going on, and it's sort of being done on the sly. You know, hey, you know, load that up into the boat, we'll be fine. The other is that you have rogue individuals who are in a position of authority on board the ship, and they have taken it upon themselves to pad their income by engaging in illicit activity. In this case, the ship pulls out of port. They don't say where this happened. And we don't know how it is that the feds knew to go after this ship. But I'm guessing there was some measure of surveillance taking place that enabled them to figure out cocaine was being moved, drugs were being moved. They were in Cristobal, Panama. They were in Buenaventura, Colombia. They were in Callao, Peru. This kind of stuff isn't really going to fly in Peru. So my best guess, they're also at Freeport in the Bahamas, but there's no one moving a ton of cocaine out of the Bahamas. My best guess is after they left, they actually went from Colombia to Peru and then back to Cristobal. So here's my theory, just a theory. The first officer, who seems to be the mastermind behind this whole thing, makes a deal when they're in Colombia and says, get everything ready. We'll be back out near Colombia at this point. They go to Peru, pick up cargo, and then on their way back, 14 boats show up in the middle of the night, and they are loading massive amounts of cocaine onto the boat. 16.5 tons of cocaine, which means that every boat was carrying at least 1 ton of cocaine. Cocaine is not a high volume product. You got to grow a lot of coca to get a ton of cocaine, and you have to do a lot of processing to get a ton of cocaine. This may represent somebody's entire output for a quarter or for 6 months. This is 16 and a half tons, $1 billion street value of cocaine for a ship ultimately that was bound for the Netherlands and Europe. So was this bound for the United States? Were they going to offload this in the United States and the East Coast can say goodbye to cocaine this summer? Or was this all going to Europe and Europe can say goodbye to cocaine this summer? One way or another, there is going to be a massive, and I mean massive, cocaine shortage someplace, because you don't take 16 and a half tons of cocaine out of circulation without a lot of people sitting around saying, hey, what happened to the drugs? Why can't I get the drugs anymore? Good news, marijuana is legal. It's all you need. Just smoke the marijuana. You don't need the cocaine. This is industrial movement of narcotics. We hear about the drug bus along the Mexican border where people will hide bags of drugs in statues, or they'll hide bags of drugs under crates of fruit, or they'll hide bags of drugs in the wheel well of a car. They're getting maybe 50 kilos, 100 kilos is considered a big bust. This is 16 and a half tons. This is somebody's entire supply for, I don't know. I can't do the math to convert 16 and a half tons of cocaine into grams and figure out how many individual doses that turns into. And I'm assuming this is uncut cocaine too, which means this is actually more than that. This is the entire supply for a major part of a continent that has been interdicted by the United States. This is a major drug bust. And the thing about a major drug bust like this is it is going to come with consequences for the people who were hoping to ship those drugs wherever. Now, I'm guessing this came out of Colombia because Peru has a pretty hardcore zero tolerance policy for anything to do with drugs. You do not want to be caught with drugs in Peru. You do not want to be caught manufacturing or distributing drugs in Peru. They will throw you in a damp, dark cell for a very, very long time. And I believe in some cases, Peru has the death penalty for drug trafficking. Colombia has been the seat of the cocaine production, certainly in the Americas, for decades now. But even by Colombia's standards, this is a lot of cocaine. Somebody just watched their entire drug empire implode. And when somebody's drug empire implodes, there is inevitably somebody else waiting in the wings to come in and take over, and it is followed by horrible, bloody violence. So the next stage in this story will be the coming drug war in Colombia as somebody falls from power and someone replaces them. And it will be interesting to see if we actually find out about that, because it's going to happen. You don't lose 16 and a half tons of drugs and come back from that. Even if you're the one in charge of everything, even if you're running the Medellin cartel, you lose $1 billion worth of drugs, it's over. That's done. That's all your bribe money to pay off the corrupt government officials and corrupt police and corrupt military to provide you protection while you do this. It's done. It's gone. Somebody in Colombia is going down. And this is going to make a massive, massive dent in the cocaine trade for the next 3 to 6 months. As I say, 16 and a half tons, this is somebody's entire supply probably at least through the end of the summer, if not through the end of the year. Either that or people are doing way more cocaine than I'm aware of. I don't think that's the case. There's only so much coke you can do. So we'll be keeping an eye on what happens down in Colombia to see if there's any sort of follow-up on this, to see if there's any sort of fallout, if there's any sort of shift in who's dealing the drugs. Maybe Colombia all of a sudden will round up a bunch of drug dealers because they're no longer to pay their way out of court, out of jail, out of trouble. Huge bust. I mean, just staggering. And the other thing about it that's staggering is that someone would move this much cocaine at one time. If someone is taking that big of a risk, if somebody is putting all of their product onto one ship, then there's a very, very good chance that they've done this before. These, when you're moving a large quantity of drugs, when the cartels do that, they tend to do that only when they know it's going to be safe, only when they have a proven way of doing it. It used to be they'd load it up in a small aircraft, and those airplanes would fly under radar across the United States border. And you could move, you know, several hundred pounds, maybe a ton of cocaine at a time, whatever the capacity of that aircraft was. You could move those quantities of drugs across the border. U.S. government figured out how to stop that. We know that they've been moving them by boat, and they'll have boats come out from the shore and pick up the bags that are floating in the water. The U.S. Coast Guard spends a lot of time dealing with those. We know that they move them through trucks, and we know that they try to hide them in lots of different ways and just roll them across the border in produce trucks and trucks with goods in them. This is 16 and a half. This is an industrial shipping operation. This is 16 and a half tons of powder. Just imagine that. I mean, you could sink into that and die. A lot of people could sink into that and die. 16 and a half tons of cocaine. This isn't just the largest drug bust in U.S. history. This is the largest drug bust in U.S. history by a massive, massive margin. And it doesn't come without consequences. Somebody in Colombia is going to pay the price for losing $1 billion in cocaine. And a lot of people who like cocaine are going to be sitting around somewhere in the world, maybe in the United States, maybe in Europe, saying, where's my cocaine? What happened to the cocaine? It's summertime. I wanted my cocaine. I can't get any cocaine. Is there cocaine? Why? Oh, the U.S. government has it all. How do you dispose of a 16 and a half tons of cocaine? I got to imagine small quantities of that are definitely going to go missing. I don't like that old trope about police officers like stealing drugs from the evidence room. But if you were ever going to consider pilfering a little bit of drugs for personal use, and there's 16 and a half tons of cocaine sitting there, you're probably going to take advantage of that. In world news, we talked at the time of the Christchurch shootings about the live streaming. The shooter, who is one of these anarchist individuals who just wants to watch the world burn, live streamed his attack on a mosque and an Islamic center in Christchurch, New Zealand, in which 51 people were killed. At the time, that live stream was watched by a small number of people and then immediately downloaded and reposted on Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, other services. Facebook and YouTube and Twitch moved to take it down as quickly as they possibly could. Now, I maintained at the time that was a mistake, that this video should be online, that this video should be viewable for anybody who wants to see it. I don't think anybody should be compelled to watch this video. I have the greatest respect and support for the families who don't want this material being available. My heart goes out to the families involved in this. Very few people are actually identifiable in this video, at least in the version of it that I saw back when this happened. I understand it's sensitive for them. At the same time, this is a what we would call in the news business, in journalism, a primary source. This is a document of fact that clearly shows what took place inside the mosque and in the time before the shooting, in the time between the shootings. It has a tremendous public value because it allows you to see firsthand what these kinds of attacks look like. It allows you to understand what the horror of gun violence is. It shatters any illusion you could possibly have about what happens when a gunman walks into a building and opens fire. It also has documentary value, it has historic value, and it has news value. And times were not that long ago when if a disturbing piece of video met those criteria, that video would be posted online and people would be able to view it. We have now, for some reason, moved beyond this. And that is not a good place for us to be as a society, because we do not want tech companies, Facebook, Google, YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, any of them. We do not want those companies deciding what will and will not be allowed online, particularly when we are dealing with a primary source. This video should be available. People should be able to see it for themselves. I don't recommend it. Damn thing gave me nightmares. And really nothing gives me nightmares other than when I try and quit smoking and my body is in distress and it just wants to torment me. But I got nightmares from this video. And this is one of those things that you watch and it just sort of chews away at you. The Daniel Pearl video is another one. And why do I watch these things? Do I watch them because I'm a ghoul? No, I watch them because I come in here every week and talk about what's going on. And as part of my research, I want to know as much as possible about the things that are happening. I want to know as much as I can about the events and the people who took part in them so that I can give you both informed fact and reasonable, nuanced commentary. We do both on this show. It is first and foremost an opinion show. I think you figured that out by now. But there is solid journalistic principle behind it. I am a former journalist. I am a former newspaper editor. Okay? I can say things here that I could never say in a newspaper article. And try and put things in context and help people understand what's going on. When you take primary sources away from me, when you say, no, you can't read the manifesto, journalist, you can't watch the video, journalist, I now have to stab in the dark. I now have to imagine what happened. And we don't want that. We don't want our journalists imagining what happened. We want people having access to primary sources. And I believe in a free society, we want as many people as possible to have access to primary sources so that they can see them and understand them and judge them for themselves. And if you want to put it up on a website and password protect it, I have no problem with that. If you want to ask me to give you my email address and prove to you that I am over the age of 18, I have no problem with that. Children under no circumstances should ever see something like this. There are plenty of adults who under no circumstances should ever see something like this. Some people have the capacity to handle material like this. Some people do not. I respect that. And one of the reasons that, as a journalist, I go out and I watch this stuff is so that I can present it to you, all the people who don't want to watch it, don't want to see it, so that I can explain to you what's there and what happens in it in a way that is removed from the actual experience of seeing it. And believe me, you don't want to. So I was very alarmed when this video all of a sudden disappeared from everywhere. I was also very alarmed when New Zealand said they were going to prosecute people for sharing the video. They've done just that. And interestingly, I am not alarmed by this particular case. From the BBC, New Zealand man jailed for 21 months for sharing Christchurch shooting video. Now, that's the sort of headline that immediately gets my freedom and liberty hackles up. I'm immediately like, what do you mean you put the guy in jail? A New Zealand man who shared a live stream video of the Christchurch mosque attacks has been jailed for 21 months. Philip Arps sent the video to 30 people and to a friend, asking for it to be modified to include a kill count. Christchurch District Judge Stephen O'Driscoll said Arps held unrepentant views toward the Muslim community. A gunman killed 51 people in the attack on Muslims at a mosque and Islamic center during Friday prayers in March. At the Christchurch District here's a tongue twister for you. At the Christchurch District Court, say that 10 times fast, on Tuesday, Arps pleaded guilty to two charges of distributing objectionable material for sharing footage that was live streamed to social media during the attack. The court heard that Arps had also intended to share a modified video, which included crosshairs and a kill count. He had described the modified footage as awesome, the New Zealand Herald reports. Judge O'Driscoll condemned Arps' actions, calling them a hate crime. He added that it was particularly cruel of Arps to share the video in the days after the attacks. The judge added that a pre-sentence report raised other issues about Arps that were concerning, but said he did not want to mention them publicly, as this could be seen by Arps as a badge of honor. The 44-year-old businessman had pleaded guilty in April. He was also convicted in 2016 of offensive behavior for leaving a pig's head at the Al-Noor Mosque, one of those targeted during the Christchurch mass shooting. Australian Brenton Tarrant faces 92 charges in relation to the shootings at the Al-Noor Mosque and the Lynwood Islamic Center in Christchurch. Earlier this week, he pleaded not guilty to all charges and is expected to face trial next year. The 15 March attack was New Zealand's deadliest mass shooting in modern times. So, no, I do not have a problem with Mr. Arps going to jail at all. In fact, I think Mr. Arps probably should spend some time in jail. I think 21 months is probably excessive. Maybe a year would be enough. But we're dealing with an individual who is not trying to share a primary source. He is not approaching this video from a historic perspective or a journalistic perspective. He thinks it's funny. He thinks it's funny that this happened. And he has a history of targeting this particular... He left a pig's head at the Al-Noor Mosque, which is about the worst thing you could do. It is an incredibly hostile act. Muslims do not eat pork or pigs. It is a very hostile act to leave a pig's head at the door of the mosque. And then here he is later on with a video of Muslims being murdered, and he wants someone to put crosshairs on it and a kill count. This is bad behavior. And even when you take the First Amendment into account, New Zealand, of course, doesn't have it. New Zealand and most of the Commonwealth nations take a much narrower view of freedom of speech than we do in this country. And you only discover that if you really start looking into what's going on over there. And you start looking at the way that they cover certain stories and what people can and cannot say. But in this particular case, if you were going to take this video, this tragic, and it is tragic, it is horrifying to watch this. It is horrifying to see what happens to these people. These are people who've gone to church. These are people who are worshiping their God. That's all. And then this gentleman comes in. I shouldn't even call him. This individual comes in. I regret using the word gentleman. First word that came to my mouth. This individual comes in and opens fire and just starts killing them, slaughtering them where they stand. And Mr. Arps thinks it would be funny to have somebody put crosshairs on those people and thinks it would be funny to add a kill count to the video. You are taking an historic document and turning it into a tool for hate. Now, I don't normally get on board with the concept of hate speech. I think it is too broadly defined. I think it is used far too often from people who just don't want to hear a certain perspective, who just don't want to hear someone speak, who feel that they're being oppressed, whether they are or not. So I don't generally go for the hate speech argument. In this case, no problem. No problem. I'm 100% on board with New Zealand on this. You cannot have this. You cannot have this. It is one thing to take that video. I was on the board of directors of the Boston Underground Film Festival many years ago. And one of the videos that was submitted to us was an art piece where someone had taken the 9/11 video, the news footage from 9/11, and cut it together with a song and images of hardcore pornography to make an artistic statement. This video was hugely, hugely controversial within the members of the selection committee. This video did not show anybody getting hurt. This video did not show the people jumping out of the building or the people falling out of the building or any of that. But it was still, I think this was a year after 9/11 when this video was submitted to us. It was still very raw in people's minds, and it was incredibly controversial. We ultimately wound up showing that video. And there was another video that we had where someone had actually gone out and made what they thought was a funny film about child molesting. And everyone, half of the people on the committee thought that the fictional child molesting video was going to make everyone freak out. Half the people thought the 9/11 video was going to make everyone freak out. As it turns out, the 9/11 video did not make anyone freak out. The fake child molesting video did. There was nothing graphic in that fake child molesting video, by the way. It was just the way the story was told. And it was told no children were harmed. I don't want to get into a digression on what is and isn't art, except to say that what had been done with the 9/11 footage was not intended to re-victimize the people who were harmed by that event. It was an artistic statement that put 9/11 in a greater context of American culture. And did it do so well? That's up to the individual to decide. Some people like art. Some people don't like art. Some people don't like certain types of art. Did this thing go too far? Yeah, I think it probably did. But I also thought it deserved to be seen. What Mr. Arps is doing is not art. What Mr. Arps is doing is taking a tragedy and repackaging it for maximum pain. He is repackaging it in such a way that narrow-minded people who hate can sit there and laugh at the deaths of the innocent. That is loathsome. That is reprehensible. And that, by the way, is part of the reason the big tech companies don't want this video being online. Because the next thing you know, someone has turned it into a meme. The next thing you know, there are 1,000 10-second GIFs of the thing floating around all over Twitter and YouTube and Facebook. That's the problem that you run into, is these social media companies, these big tech giants, know they cannot control it if they put it online. That as soon as it gets out there, people are going to start doing things like what Mr. Arps did. I cannot defend that. Even in the United States, on the basis of free speech and freedom of expression, the intent of what Mr. Arps wanted to do, putting crosshairs and a kill count on the Christchurch video, is to inflame, is to incite hate, is to terrorize people who are Muslim. And I have no problem with him going to jail. And I can understand on a certain level why you don't want that video being online. I still think it is incredibly wrong for that video not to be online. That we, in a free society, should demand access to primary sources. Now, if New Zealand wants to sit there and say, we don't have that law, we don't respect that, you don't get access to primary sources, Americans, okay, maybe they can make that argument. If it was live streamed to anyone in America and an American has a copy of it, I don't think New Zealand has any claim over it at all. It is horrifying. What Mr. Arps was doing was 20 times more, more than 20 times more. I cannot imagine what goes through the mind and the heart of someone who could look at that video and say, oh, you know what this needs? This needs a kill count and some crosshairs. And then it will be awesome. That's how he described the video. Awesome. And this, by the way, is what Mr. Tarrant was going for. This is what Brenton Tarrant was looking for. He wanted people to take this video. He wanted people to keep it online and keep throwing it in people's faces and to ratchet up the rhetoric. Because Mr. Tarrant believes he is going to start a civil war. That's his stated goal, if you read his manifesto, which is, like most manifestos, poorly written. If you're not Ted Kaczynski, I don't like your manifesto. But that was his goal. And that's part of the reason that we had this collective freakout and said, the video has to come down. The video should be available. I stand by that. But someone like Mr. Arps, who is going to weaponize it and use it to hurt people, someone who has a demonstrated history of antagonizing Muslims, absolutely deserves to go to jail for what he was planning to do.
Don't know why. There's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather.
Can you have it both ways? Can you have art and throw people in jail for going too far? Maybe I'm a hypocrite. No, I don't think so. Your Boston 5-day forecast. It's been a little humid lately, hasn't it? That's going to stick with us for a couple more days. But mostly in the form of rain. Showers late tonight, lows in the mid-60s. Tomorrow, thunderstorms, high around 70, lows in the mid-60s. Friday, just rain, high around 70, lows in the mid-60s. And then Saturday and Sunday, how about a nice, nice summer weekend? Mostly sunny both days. High is 74 Saturday, 80 on Sunday. Lows in the mid-60s both nights and low humidity. Perfect, comfortable, enjoyable summer weather. Rain comes during the week. Sun comes out on the weekend. We'll take that. This is Massachusetts. We never get that. It is WMFO. This is The Big Picture. On the 10 with Mikey D is going to be coming your way at 9 o'clock tonight with everything you need to know about the Boston music scene. When we come back, I mentioned last week that the story of the decade had begun to unfold. The story that is going to shape the next 10 years and basically dominate our media cycle for the next 10 years. And that was the investigation of big tech. The Justice Department, the Commerce Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, everybody in Washington, D.C. is gunning for big tech right now. There are two particular issues involving YouTube, and we're going to talk about both of them. One of which affects YouTube creators, one of which affects all of us. Right after this, here on WMFO, Medford.
A ranger station.
I'd like to report a bear hug.
Okay.
I put out my campfire and Smokey Bear hugged me.
So you drowned the fire, you stirred it, drowned it again, and felt that it was cold?
Uh-huh.
Yep, he's just letting you know you did good.
Bear hug from Smokey Bear. Status update.
I'm gonna let you go now.
There are many ways to start a fire, but one sure way to put it out. Learn how you can do your part at SmokeyBear.com.
gonna soak up the sun.
But I'm